Welcome back, everybody, to the Minnesota Sports Insider Podcast. After taking a year-long hiatus, we are back a day later on episode 2 of season 2. Yesterday, we kind of talked the entire 60 minutes of Vikings draft, free agents, and trade targets. I hope you listened to that. If not, take a listen. Now on episode 2, I'm here with Brandon again. We're going to talk more Twins notes today and finish off with a little bit of Wolves stuff.
So with that, a couple things that we're going to be going over today to start off the podcast will be with the Twins. We'll talk about what just happened the other day that Jeff Passan reported from ESPN today. We'll be going over some of the pieces of the rotation with Hill, Pineda, and a lot more. We're going to be going over some pieces of the farm system briefly. We'll get some questions from emailers. We're hoping for at least like 5 or 6 questions. Maybe more if it allows it. And then we're also going to try to put in place where the new acquisitions that we got in regards to Homer Bailey, Rich Hill, and Maeda, and where they slot in to the rotation. So with that, let's get started with this podcast.
Let's talk about first, Brandon's going to take over most of this Twins podcast because I talked the entire time yesterday. We're going to talk about what's going on at the MLB Players Association and the federal health officials.
Yeah, so today, today and last night was a pretty big day for the baseball, potentially. It came out that MLB, PA, and the union, and the federal health officials came together, and they kind of came to an agreement that it would be safe to continue the MLB season, if doing so in Arizona would permit. They would all be playing in Arizona during the MLB regular season. And I believe, I don't know if this is clarified, I would assume there would be some short stint of spring training so everybody could get warmed up with that.
Brandon, is that with fans or without fans going to these games?
No, it sounds like it's going to be without fans. Absolutely, for I would assume the short stint of spring training games we have to get all these guys situated, and I would also assume that they're probably going to have empty seats too going forward into May, maybe into June. But it kind of was pretty interesting to hear that already in May, potentially the first week. That wasn't really detailed in the statement. But not sure when in May, but regardless, this is the first sport we've heard, you know, outside of individual spaced out sports, isolated sports. It's the first kind of big move for professional sports. So, I mean, I know Adam Silver made his point very, very strong the other day of saying we are yet to make a decision for at least a couple of weeks regarding this. We don't feel comfortable with that decision. But so a lot of people are siding with Adam Silver on this. But I think from the other side of the spectrum, for all the sport fans and for all the enthusiasts that need this entertainment, it is a sigh of relief to maybe have the thought of, okay, we might start some sort of baseball in May. That's nice to hear. I don't know what you think about that, Brent.
Just having it come back in May, it'd be nice to have some normalcy back in the world and back in the United States of not being scared anymore. And with this starting up, maybe it's a sign of going forward with positivity. How would this affect the Twins with the arms we signed, with some of the new free agents that are coming in? I know they had a brief spring training stint, but what does this mean for all of the major league in general and the Twins especially?
It'll be interesting to see what happens to the farm systems, I think, through this process. First, so if this plan's in place for everyone to play in Arizona for the MLB, what does that look like for the minor leagues? Are they going to put an area designated for just AAA and then AA and single A and low A? Because that's a lot of space and time and baseball equipment. And you can go down to Florida and do the same thing with AAA, but can you do that with three other leagues? I don't know if you can do that. So that's going to be interesting from like how that impacts the Twins. Well, it impacts our top prospects, because now you're talking about, instead of maybe Royce Lewis and Kirilloff and Larnick and Balazovic and Yoan Duran, you know, they were going to get all maybe 120 games, you know, in their respective seasons or more. And now it's not looking like that. It's looking like it could be less, unless the MLB finds an area for them to play at. But the other thing I want to talk about with some of the stipulations that the MLBPA put out today is some things to think about if they go into Arizona in May. And I don't know if this means we go – this is the interesting part. Does that mean we play in Arizona, the MLB, the entire season all the way through September? Or does that mean it's just a plan right now for May and potentially June? I don't know. But that's a big if, and that definitely hurts our market as the Twins financially.
Let's say this planned and start in May in Arizona doesn't come to fruition. Okay, let's say this postpones a couple more months or whatever it is. What do you think that means for MLB service time or guys on a one-year contract or guys that just signed a four-year contract? What does that mean for them going forward or for organizations?
That's a great question. Like I kind of think like, is it in a sense going to be like prorated? Take the percentage of 162 game season in the MLB and say they have to play this X amount of games, X amount of innings to qualify for a year against your arbitration or your service time, your proverbial clock that has started.
Can you maybe describe what arbitration means for listeners out there?
Yeah, so like guys that actually are entering the MLB, right? You have all this time when you sign your entry or your rookie contract, you know, but it's in the minor league. So your clock has not started technically. What I mean by clock is when, as soon as you touch the MLB and you reach a certain amount of games, your clock has started for arbitration. Typically now, like they're trying to fix this so younger players don't reach their first contract after the age of 30, because we're seeing a lot of that. They're trying to fix that, and that's probably going to change in the next few years. But currently, and the way it's been, is that once your clock starts, so let's say when Byron Buxton got to the MLB and he played his first year over like is it 80 or 100 games, your clock starts, and that counts as 1 year against your arbitration. You get 6 years of arbitration before you're eligible to be a free agent, essentially. And go out on the market. So that'll be interesting how they affect that. So I wonder if they take that same percentage for 162 games and use that for however many games that. So let's say it's 115 game season, 120 game season this year. Let's say it's that. I wonder if now you only have to play 80 or 70 games for that to count against arbitration. And the same thing kind of goes with the minor leagues. Like, do they still get paid the same amount? I'm not sure. That's a good question. We'll see how that goes. But it's definitely looking like it's going to be a completely different look for the MLB going forward. But with that being said, the last thing I'm going to say about this before we move on to some questions really pertaining to the Twins is it's kind of interesting looking at some of the things they talked about with how they're going to structure the games down in Arizona. A couple of the ideas that were being tossed around is that they're going to have seven-inning doubleheader games. Again, I would assume that's just for the month of May. Otherwise, we'd reach our total amount of games pretty quickly, and we'd go over by late August if we did doubleheaders the entire time. So that's pretty much out of the question. But it'd be interesting. Are we doing doubleheaders? Are we going to do seven-inning games? I find that extremely unlikely. I think that would look – that would be very – I think a lot of folk would definitely be not happy about that. I would assume that you can find a way to get in maybe 1 day a week. This is for the month of May, of doubleheaders, or maybe 2 days a week where you do doubleheaders against divisional opponents. So if you're looking to change the schedule, because that's the big question, how do you get around this with the whole month of April of games? What do you do with them? Do you start in April, or do you start where the calendar says? I think for divisional games, you do double headers on a certain day when that lands. So then you can catch up with the games later.
And that would be really interesting for managers in general as far as 7-inning games, because they're used to 9-inning games where they've got setup guys, they've got relief guys they want to go to in the 7th, 8th, and 9th inning. Now what do you do in 7-inning games? Because typically your starting pitchers can last 7 innings. They can last 8 innings. They can last 6 innings. But now do you only pitch them 4 innings? Do you pitch them 5? So that'd be really interesting for managers going forward.
My very last thing about this is some of the things that are being talked about. This seems like it could be more likely than the 7-inning doubleheader. This seems like it's very possible, at least for the month of May, if we come back onto the field in Arizona. This is describing from ESPN that umpires in the game will be have implemented an electronic strike zone, and the ump will be 6 feet behind both the catcher and or the batter. So that would actually take account for if there was is that possibly taking account for if there's a wrong call? Can you now just look back onto the electronic strike zone? And it's as simple as that. There's no review. It's basically just you look back at the strike. I just don't know what that really means. It seems pretty broad right now. And I don't know how the electronic strike zone would be implemented. But the one other thing that's going to be added on to the MLB game, regardless of the shortened season that they already decided back in February, is that for the first time in MLB history, the umpires are going to have an actual audience and microphone for everyone in the ballpark to hear when they're discussing the review on the field. So they're now going to have the NFL mics essentially live, but they're going to be talking even through the situation itself.
I think that's a really cool idea, because I think fans in general, when MLB umpires or NFL officials, when they come together and huddle up and talk about something, I think fans kind of want to hear what they're saying. Moving forward here, talking about the Twins offseason in general here, the Twins prioritized starting pitching going into the offseason. We struck out on guys like Mad Bum, Zach Wheeler, all those top profile, top of the line arms, and we essentially settled on trading for Kenta Maeda. Why do you think Maeda was the right choice over guys like Mad Bum, Robbie Ray, Zach Wheeler, Dallas Keuchel?
You know, I'll say one thing quickly. Eliminate Mad Bum, even though, like, let's just say that he wanted to go to Arizona. He has his ranch there. He could, obviously took less money than what he could have got. So let's just eliminate Mad Bum. But let's remember to include Robbie Ray, Wheeler, and Keuchel, like you said. So why is Maeda better than Rob, or a better choice for the Twins with Robbie Ray? Because simply this, Robbie Ray's contract at the end of this year is expiring. And that means that he's going to ask for a big contract, because I want to say Robbie Ray is about 28, 29 years old, and he's been top 10 the last two straight years in strikeouts in the MLB. His ERA has been about around the 3.9. It's been good. It's been about a number two starter worthy, but with elite strikeout potential. That's going to warrant at least if Zach Wheeler got, what was it, almost about $25 million a year, and if Dallas Keuchel got about $18 million a year, then I mean, it's pretty easy to see that Robbie Ray's going to get at least 20-something million a year when his contract comes up. And I don't see the Twins spending $20 million more when we have Jake Odorizzi coming up for a contract extension. He only opted into the $17 million qualifying offer for $17 million this offseason. But I think that it would make a lot of sense to stay away from Robbie Ray. And why is Maeda so interesting? Well, he is 31 years old, right? And he has 4 years of complete team control where he's under contract at a base salary of $4 million a year, right? And with incentives, so let's just say I'll give you an example of what his contract looks like. So he gets $4 million regardless every single year, Maeda. That's a pretty good base salary for the Twins GMs to work with cap situation. And you look at the incentives. So let's say Maeda pitches 175 innings and he has 150 strikeouts. I mean, and he's easily at over 9.0 strikeout per nine innings. So he'll easily reach that. If he reaches that, his incentives go up all the way, and his total base salary now becomes essentially $10 million. So even if Maeda pitches at like a number two or even slightly a number one, let's say he somehow gets over 200 innings pitched for the first time in his career, and he's dominant. He very well could be. He still would not be paid over $12 million with incentives total. So we're getting a pitcher for 4 years of control at the age of 31 who can potentially being the top of our rotation. We might get into that a little later. And you're getting him at a great price over guys like Robbie Ray. Wheeler, like I said, has 25 million, and Keuchel has 17 or 18 million. So that's how I see Maeda's fit so well with the Twins. And adding a guy who has a really, really good split change and a really dominant slider is something the Twins do need at the starting rotation.
All right, let's transition here to a few questions. Some of these are from me, just kind of talking back and forth with Brandon. Some are from people sending them in. The first one, I kind of talked to Brandon about this earlier, and I want to kind of hear his thoughts. Do you think our bullpen is set in stone, or do we possibly add a free agent that's still out there late in the year? Or is there a trade target we could look at for a possible back end of the rotation, or maybe a middle of the road kind of guy?
Yeah, well, right now, so we added Tyler Clippard. Tyler Clippard, you know, to our bullpen. So we already have Trevor May, Taylor Rogers, Tyler Duffy. Those are kind of our workhorse guys. You know, we have Zach Littell in there to help. Who knows where Lewis Thorpe falls in the rotation or not? Who knows if Randy Dobnak falls in there or not? But the interesting thing about Tyler Clippard is, because I named a lot of pitchers right there, but right now, if you're not including Rich Hill, if you're not including Lewis Thorpe, Taylor Rogers and maybe a minor leaguer are only lefties in the bullpen currently. But if you look at Tyler Clippard's actual splits and his stats, he's honestly a left-handed pitcher. And what do I mean by that? He does throw from the right side, but typically the same hand and the same sided for hitting and pitching typically warrants success for the pitcher. It's tough on the angle. So opposite sides usually benefit the hitter. But in this situation, Clippard's special against lefties. He's a right-handed pitcher, but he's near dominant against lefties, and he's actually really bad against righties. So he's now tie that in with the new idea of you can't have the lefty specialist is almost out of the game because of the new rule that they implemented. You have to face three batters, right? So you can walk all three, but you got to face three batters. And if that's the case, how valuable is Clippard? I'm not sure. I think that poses back to your point, Brent, of do we need to add another arm in free agency? I know there's Fernando Rodney out there, right? I know there's a couple young, cheap options that are guys that are veterans that have been there before for a team that's in a win-now situation. You know, is Clippard enough to add to the bullpen? And then you know, what do you think, Brent, we didn't see a lot of Gratterall, and we don't need to get in depth about that, but what do you think of losing Gratterall does to the potential of what our bullpen could have been?
I think Gratterall was maybe our best bullpen arm coming in. He could have been a long relief guy, a late inning guy, a late game guy, just because he was a starting pitcher coming up. And I know a lot of people are upset that we traded him, but like I said on Twitter, the minute this trade happened, we got to look at this one of two ways. Okay, Twins fans, Vikings fans, whatever sport you're a fan of, we've always sat here and said, why aren't the Twins trading top-of-the-line prospects to get a starting pitcher in here, which we need, or to get whatever position we need? Or why aren't the Timberwolves trading player X for a three-guard to come in here, a bona fide stud? And now we do trade one of our top guys for a very good starting pitcher that isn't necessarily an ace, but he's going to come in here and solidify our starting rotation. To whereas last year, we didn't have someone that you could count on in the third game of a series, and you're okay. Let's go. Let's play. We got Kenta Maeda out here. Let's play. People were upset that we traded Brusdar. So you either have to be on one side of the fence. You can't be someone that says I'm happy or we need to trade one of our top end guys, and then come back after we trade him and say why are we trading him? Because we just did what you wanted us to do, right? Yeah. I was perfectly fine trading Brusdar Gratterall because we have guys in our farm system that can come up and be Brusdar. He's not necessarily throwing 100 miles an hour, but they're just as good as he is down there in the farm system. Let's go to a question from Skyler in Minneapolis. What other AL Central team do you think proposes the biggest threat to the Twins this year?
Good question. So this is interesting now because, you know, obviously last year it was just Cleveland. It wasn't the Whites, you know, the White Sox or the Royals or the Tigers. It was clearly the Cleveland Indians. Now, you know, they've lost Corey Kluber and they traded him and they get Nomar Mazara back in the trade and they added Hernandez from the Phillies as a second baseman. So they've added some pieces offensively. I believe Yasiel Puig is now gone from their team. So they've kind of moved around some pieces offensively while adding, Jason Kipnis is now pretty much out of the picture as a starter over there, with the new starter from the Phillies coming over to second base to fill that spot. And I will say, I mean, he's a good little add, but losing Kluber, you know, albeit they didn't have a healthy Kluber and they did it completely without him pretty much last year. So that's interesting. Their rotation of the Indians, it's really interesting to look at. They keep developing arms and really young arms. So they have Aaron Civale. He's 24 years old. He throws about 95. And they all seem to have this really, really strong curveball that falls off the table. And it's just so dynamic because the difference in speed between their fastball and their ability to locate the fastball high and throw the 12-6 low is so hard as a hitter when the eye levels are constantly changing every pitch. And that seems like a constant trend with Terry Francona's staff. When he was in Boston, they won and they pitched well and they developed an extremely good rate, even though they had a big market. Then he goes to Cleveland and he, you know, once again, they develop. So they have Aaron Civale. Shane Bieber is a budding star in the AL. He was a Cy Young Award candidate last year. People forget about it. He was the All-Star MVP, striking out three guys in 10 pitches. And he was pretty much their ace last year, along with another guy who's a Cy Young candidate, Mike Clevinger, throwing 96, 97. Looks like Cinderella out there, but I mean, he's a bulldog, a lot like Trevor Bauer. And that's another thing. They lost Trevor Bauer, but they still get back another prospect in that trade.
All right, moving forward here.
Well, hold on.
Oh, one more thing, sorry.
You know, but let's add one quick thing to that is, you know, with the Indians, you need to understand that their offense is not going to be elite, but if they do keep Francisco Lindor, you know, and they still have obviously Jose Ramirez, that rotation with Civale and Shane Bieber, Clevinger, Zach Plesac, Dan Plesac on MLB Network's son, there's a lot of talent in that rotation, and we're not even talking about Carlos Carrasco. And he's probably going to be the fifth starter in that rotation. The other team that we need to talk about quickly is the Chicago White Sox. And they have an interesting rotation with Lucas Giolito. He can definitely throw about 97, 98. He's right now kind of their ace. He was an all-star last year. He was pretty dominant the entire year. The second guy they acquired was Dallas Keuchel this offseason. He is probably going to fill into the two spot in their rotation. They have Carlos Rodon, who's their third starter and probably is a pretty serviceable third starter. He's been up and down at some times. He's a fastball curveball mixed pitcher. So their rotation is, I would say, fairly identical, not in terms of pitching styles, but in terms of pitching talent and output for rotations with the Twins. And their batting order is kind of what separates the White Sox this year from last year. They have all these prospects that are coming up. Tim Anderson, a shortstop that's really coming up the ranks in any level in the MLB. He's going to probably be an all-star, it seems like, yearly the way he's going, developing. They have Yo Moncada. They're signing prospects that haven't even played a game in the MLB and to long-year contracts. So there's a lot of things going on with the White Sox. They have a solid rotation. Their lineup's going to be probably around top 10 in the MLB. A lot of young players that haven't done it at the MLB level but have a ton of potential. So, you know, I'm looking at the White Sox to be anywhere from their floor is probably 75 wins, you know, but I see them really being an 80, you know, 85 or 90 win team if they stay healthy. But that's definitely a threat there. The Indians look to be a very good team again this year, probably around 90 wins. So it'll be interesting to see the dynamic there with the Indians, the White Sox, and the Twins. You know, the Royals and the Tigers, they're going to be rebuilding at least this year and the next year.
I've kind of got another one here. Where do you see Kenta Maeda fitting into our rotation? We obviously know he's not going to be our ace. It's a mix of, is he going to be the number two guy? Is he going to be the number three guy? I would kind of consider him to be behind Odo and be our third guy. I think he's a really solid third option.
So the rotation, the way it looks right now, it's looking like, you know, Barrios is going to be the number one. And Rocco has already made it clear that Barrios is going to be our starting day, you know, our opening day starter, whenever that date is. And everything behind Barrios is kind of a mystery. The interesting part of this big delay in the coronavirus is simply the fact that Rich Hill wasn't supposed to play until June. And Michael Pineda was suspended for 35 or 37 more games. So those are interesting parts that weren't going to be, regardless at the beginning of the year, in our rotation. But now Rich Hill very well could be literally playing at the beginning of the season. So signing Homer Bailey and signing Chacin, I'm not sure what that does for you going forward with depth. Do they just, because Ulys Chacin happens to be on a minor league contract, so he can play in AAA this year. Does that mean he can fit in our bullpen? I'm not sure. He's a right-handed pitcher. He throws his slider more than anything. It's his best pitch. He's very dominant against righties. He's poor against lefties. Could he fill in as a sixth-inning guy reliever in the bullpen? I don't know. And then Homer Bailey, does he have a place in the rotation now? Because we have Barrios, who's guaranteed a spot. Odorizzi, who's guaranteed a spot. Pineda will be coming off after 30 games. However they figure out the suspension, you're going to have Rich Hill come off his injury, and then ultimately you have Homer Bailey.
And that's a really good point, because last year, Pineda looked really good for us as our fifth starter. If he can come in and be a fourth or fifth starter, I think we have a really good rotation.
Yeah, and Pineda seemed to figure out with Wes Johnson a couple things in regards to his command and his control and which side of the mound he was going to deliver off of, which that changed in prior years. So a couple mechanical tweaks, and it seems like they really managed his innings well last year, even before the suspension, which was nice to see, because I think he will be the proverbial, he'll be cold because of the suspension and everything. But I do think he's going to be really well rested. And this, like, for everything that people like to talk about with the Twins and how this affects us, it really benefits Rich Hill, you know, and it really benefits Michael Pineda, because they're going to have shorter seasons. And Rich Hill is old. I think he's 39. I'm not sure if Rich Hill can go a full 162 game season anymore, but if he's coming back and we don't have to almost lose any games with him missing from injury, from the surgery and rehab, that's a really good thing for the Twins. Rich Hill's our fourth guy or third guy slotted into our rotation as a lefty pitcher, the only lefty that's currently in our rotation, then that's a really, really good thing for the Twins. And Pineda is an interesting fit there. And I just wonder, is Homer Bailey going to be for sure the fifth starter if that happens? Because now it's, okay, Randy Dobnik, I'm sorry, you're going to the bullpen, or you're going to the minor leagues, or we're going to have to designate you for assignment. Or is it like, what's going to happen with Lewis Thorpe and all those other pitchers? There's just so many things. So that'll be interesting to see. Right now I have Barrios, Odorizzi, Rich Hill, Homer Bailey, and Kenta Maeda is my five when everyone's healthy. And I don't know what that means for the rest of the rotation and guys like Lewis Thorpe and such.
So you have Kenta as your fifth starter, or that's just five you listed off?
That's just the five I listed off. You know, I don't really know about the order of that rotation right now. I would probably guess it's Barrios, then Odorizzi, then Maeda. Then if Hill's healthy, you probably want a lefty after three straight righties. Rich Hill, I guess it all depends too. But and then Homer Bailey last maybe. But either way, your top three seems pretty set in stone with Berríos, Odorizzi, and Maeda.
That kind of goes into the next question I was going to ask. How deep do you think our rotation is? Do you think we go four starters? Do you go five starters? Does it depend on where we are in the season, on the week? What do you think? Is it four or five starters that we go deep?
I don't like when the season's already starting, like in Arizona.
Let's say we're 2 months into the year. Are we a four rotation guy or a five rotation guy?
I guess it completely depends on what the schedule is. If there's double headers, then that changes everything. Then you probably have a completely different approach, and maybe you have multiple openers on that day. And maybe the MLB is already talking about we're going to expand rosters beyond the 26 man roster. So I don't know what's going to happen there. It's pretty hard to pinpoint. It'd just be interesting to watch the development beyond Maeda, Berríos, and Odorizzi and see what Bailey and Rich Hill can provide to our team. Let's take a couple more questions. We have a couple. One from John in St. Louis Park. What are some possible pitchers to target? We kind of already answered that. We don't really need it. I would say, John, like what pitchers to target? I wouldn't target anybody right now. I would let the rotation play out. We have guys that are in our minor leagues that are, I think, going to be ready by next year for sure. I do think the five guys we have in our rotation are enough right now, and I wouldn't want to sacrifice trading away top prospects at this point.
Going off of that, let's look at going into the playoffs, kind of how we did last year or the year before. 2 years ago was the one-game playoff. Last year was the series against the Yankees. We really didn't have much starting pitching depth, and now I kind of think this year we are deeper. But how comfortable are you with throwing Homer Bailey or Rich Hill or Pineda in a playoff game? Would you consider going after guys like Robbie Ray or Trevor Bauer, who are on the last year of their contract, and maybe they wouldn't request a lot back from him? What do you think?
Again, like I think Ray's gonna have a good marketplace. They're gonna, even though he's on the last year of his contract, and so is Trevor Bauer. They both, well, I'll tell you this: Trevor Bauer has said it multiple times. He's going year by year contracts. So you take that as you will. If you're Falvey or Levine, deciding of what that looks like for you. Do you like that? Because now you're not accounting for multiple years of being tied up to Trevor Bauer? Or do you not like that because every year it's $20 million for Trevor Bauer and you're going, it's a process that you're always negotiating, always managing, that you always have to be aware of when you're dealing with Trevor Bauer? You know, there's a lot of things that come with Trevor Bauer. He has a ton of good relationships with Falvey in Cleveland. Falvey was the one who actually drafted Trevor Bauer, and they actually have a book called Driveline, but it's about Driveline and Driveline mechanics and how Trevor Bauer got affiliated and all that stuff. It's pretty cool. So they do have a really good relationship there. I could see that as a one-year thing. But for fans that are like, are we going to lock up Trevor Bauer to a long-term contract? No, the answer is no, unless Bauer decides to completely change his strategy with his agent, which he said multiple times on his YouTube pod or his YouTube video that he's not going to do that. The other thing I just don't see the point of trading for a guy like that right now. Any of those guys, I would really lean on the depth of, like, if Homer Bailey's your fifth guy. You're not going to get a lot better than that, and I don't think you're going to get an ace unless sacrificing a Kirilloff or a Lewis. But I'm going to take another question here from Janice. Okay, how does the shortened season affect the Twins? We kind of went over that a little bit, Janice. We talked about how service time, how does that affect arbitration? You know, how does it affect, let's say, our depth? That's a good question that I could answer for you. We do have a lot of guys. Like, if we played 162-game season, this is probably where it hurts the Twins. we do have guys that are going to be on our bench a lot. Unless we play doubleheaders, it may be able to solve that question of depth. But we have Ari Adrianze. We have Marwin Gonzalez. I'm not sure where Tortuga Williams Acedillo fits in. And we have Jake Cave. And those are guys that are, none of those guys are currently minor league players. You know, like, they're all MLB players, and they're all serviceable MLB players. How do you fit them into the daily plan? Because if you play a 120-game season, you're, every game's going to matter, obviously, that much more, and you're going to be, you know, less, you're going to be reluctant to want to set, you know, to put them in the game when you have Donaldson, and you have Garver, and you have Sano, and this amazing lineup when every game's so important. And especially the divisional games, it's just going to be tough for them to get in unless a different format approaches with doubleheaders where they might be forced their hand. Another question I'm going to answer from Scott. Fangraphs. How does Fangraphs affect the projections for Twins players this year with the shortened season? They just came out with some of the stats from Fangraphs for the Minnesota Twins and every MLB team. They have a lot of positive reviews for Max Kepler. Looks like they're projecting Kepler to be a 270 hitter who hits roughly 35 home runs and has a slugging percentage over 520. All those stats would accumulate to a projected 4.4 wins above replacement, which also in this projection would have him third amongst all right fielders in the MLB at wins above replacement. That's a pretty high projection. Quickly about Kepler, little tidbits. Some things that look to look forward to for Kepler is the Gold Glove, the Gold Glove Award. Mookie Betts currently has won two straight Gold Glove Awards in right field for Boston, and Mookie Betts is now gone from the AL, meaning Max Kepler doesn't have to face Mookie Betts for the Gold Glove. The last 2 years in a row, Max Kepler was second behind Mookie Betts in votes at the Gold Glove. This now allows Kepler to add to his resume. He is a very, very well-graded defender amongst many deeper analytical systems, and this data from Fangraphs seems to really support that for Max Kepler. Another guy is Josh Donaldson. I think this will be interesting. Age 34 season, first year of his contract at $23 million getting paid out this year. Donaldson's projected for roughly a 4.5 wins above replacement, and he's projected to hit 265 with 34 home runs and about 102 RBIs with a 532 slugging percentage, which would, again, land Donaldson in the top 10 amongst all third basemen and would probably put him in the range of being an all-star during the season and another impact year from Donaldson. So that being said, we're going to transition just over to Brent for one moment.
All right, let's move away from questions here. I've got a couple things that Brandon can talk about. He's more in depth and knows more about the Twins than I guess I do. So he's more taking the control of this podcast. I want to talk about two things with you here. Number one, let's talk about what our potential lineup could be against lefties versus what it could look like against righties. And then let's hear maybe four or five players that you think are down in our farm that could not necessarily benefit us this year, but benefit us down the road. And what are some guys that are down there that really aren't being talked about that you think should be being talked about?
I think that a couple things with the lineup is when we're configuring a lineup, how is it going to look when we're looking at the eyes from Rocco Baldelli? When you looked at last year's lineup, Rocco put a lot of lineups together with Kepler up top at number one. He even sometimes would do that against left-handed pitchers at times. He would use Polanco, though, in some cases versus left-handed pitchers. A lot of times, Polanco and Kepler would be one and two, or vice versa. So it was interesting. Another spot that used Kepler was the fifth spot in the sixth spot last year. Sometimes the seventh spot, more often is the fifth and the sixth spot. That'll be interesting to look forward to. with the lineup. But right now, a lineup that would make sense versus right-handed pitchers for Rocco's lineup would be Arias first. And I know there's a lot of theories of why not to put Arias first, because it might put a lot of pressure on him as a 22-year-old who just had a very impressive first year hitting over 320 in his rookie campaign. It's a lot of pressure to put someone in that position to do it again your second year. But Arias does have that skill set. He's got a special talent with his bat-to-ball contact that he keeps. He's an ideal first, traditional first leadoff hitter, and that says a lot for a young man. So right now we're going to have Arias hitting first. Donaldson in the past with Atlanta, with the Toronto Braves, with the Oakland Athletics, has traditionally hit second. He's went on the record to say a couple times he likes hitting second. Polanco I have hitting third. Nelson Cruz last year hitting 310, over 40 home runs, over 100 RBIs, hitting fourth. Kepler hitting fifth. Rosario hitting sixth. Garver hitting seventh. And Sano hitting eighth, with Buxton hitting last. You could argue, a lot of people would definitely argue saying Kepler's going to be hitting first in this against a right-handed pitcher. He did all of last year. He did a good job. He got on base. He took pitches. He gave you good at-bats. It takes pressure away from putting on Arias when he's only this young, while Kepler's absolutely an established veteran in the MLB and had a fantastic year hitting over 250 and 36 homers last year. You know, but that's a couple ways to look at it. I do like Arias because I think Arias on base was north of 390 last year. Is that repeatable? I have no idea. It was his rookie year, but I would say it's very likely that he'll be at least a 360 on base guy. And if you have a 360 on base guy, you have somebody on for Donaldson, arguably your best, if not, you know, at least your second best hitter behind Cruz currently. It's not a bad idea to put a guy on base for him. Another player would be Polanco potentially moving back in the lineup, but I just like his versatility as being a switch hitter. So that's where I like that factor. The other lineup we're going to talk about really quick is versus left-handed pitchers. And a couple things to look at is I have right now Polanco leading off because he is a switch hitter. If you do run into relief pitchers coming in later, he can switch both sides. And I have Donaldson, again, hitting second, Cruz hitting third, Garver hitting fourth, Sano hitting fifth, Rosario hitting sixth, Kepler hitting seventh, and Arias hitting eighth, and Buxton hitting ninth. There's a lot of qualms that could absolutely happen with this lineup. I can argue my own lineup in a lot of ways here, because why would you have Arias hitting eighth if you believe that much that it's a good hitter? But again, maybe you just take pressure off him versus lefties, let him get adjusted into the season. Putting Rosario down on the sixth spot in both these scenarios is strictly because he frankly didn't have a great on base percentage last year. His OPS wasn't great, and a lot of underlying stats suggest that Eddie Rosario should not be a fourth hitter in any Twins lineup with this much talent. But to argue that point, once again, he did have 100 RBIs last year. So that's the big difference between the right versus a right-handed pitcher and a left-handed pitcher. A couple last things that we might want to talk about for the Twins is how do we feel with Sano's first year coming from third base to first base? It's pretty honorable that he wanted to leave third base to go to first just so Donaldson could come here. When he sent that really cool video to Donaldson's agent, they shared it with him. And actually the whole tennis player that got involved there was Marty Fish. I don't know if you know who Marty Fish is, but he's a professional tennis player up from this area. And they actually connected between Donaldson, who's actually a friend of his, who they play tennis together, and Miguel Sano's agent sent it to Marty Fish, who showed it to Donaldson, who ultimately got Donaldson along with Falvey and Levine to Minnesota. So I thought that was pretty cool. So what do we think of Miguel Sano going from third base to first base?
I think that's a big question mark because we've kind of seen how that has gone in the past with players switching positions with the Miguel Sano project in right field, how that went. I don't think Miguel Sano is a bad third baseman. He had the arm to play third, and he kind of had the mobility not necessarily to go left and right as well as a lot of people, but he wasn't bad going left and right and fielding ground balls. Moving over to first base, I think that's a really good spot for him if he is willing to put in the work, which I think he is, with the video he sent, again, just advocating that he would be willing to make that transition. And now it's just let's put in the work and let's be the best team we can be. And that was the mentality he had when he made that switch, because he was third baseman coming up. And he said multiple times before we signed Donaldson that he really wanted to play third base. And before he moved into right field, there was talks about him just being a DH. And he really didn't like that because, again, he wanted to play third. So that just goes to show how much he's matured, I guess you could say, in the 2 or 3 years since that first try and right. I guess the question mark is still out there because we really haven't seen a lot of him playing first base. We've had little glimpses in spring training, but that's really nothing compared to a regular season game.
I've listened to a couple people talk about him. I listened to James Rousen even talk about James Rousen is currently at Miami, hired under Derek Jeter now to help coach over there. So we lost him. But I heard a couple of coaches just talk about Miguel Sano's ability to adapt to each position. They keep saying and reiterating he is a very good athlete. This is the best he's been with his shape, with his fitness. This is the most muscle he's had. This is the most flexibility he's had. He's even gotten to the exceptions of trying to ask guys like Justin Morneau and looking out for even other players at first base like Albert Pujols. He's gone on his way to ask about help on the position, advice and tips, and they've been going back and forth. I know Morneau reached back out, and they actually had a one-on-one and practiced some things, and Albert Pujols sent some video back. So that's pretty cool to hear. The initiative of Miguel Sano, once again, it seems like he's a motivated, happy individual with Nelson Cruz, and that has seemed to be the puzzle to this whole thing. You know, like how do we fix Sano? How do we get him healthy? How do we keep him in the best shape so he can play at his best potential? And it seems like Nelson Cruz has really done a great job at implementing just that.
And Falvey and Levine have said multiple times that this is the best shape that Sano's been in since they've been here, and that's a really good point going forward as well. But with that being said, we're about 50 minutes in of Twins talk. Let's kind of transition here to Timberwolves talk for the last 5 to 10 minutes. This is kind of an intro, I guess you could say, to next week's podcast. It'll be really Timberwolves heavy about draft stuff and free agency and all that kind of stuff. But right now, let's kind of just run down the roster. Again, we've got Karl-Anthony Towns, D'Angelo Russell, Malik Beasley, our big three that everyone kind of knows about. Aside from them, though, we've got Naz Reid, Jarrett Culver, Josh Okogie, James Johnson, Juancho Hernangómez, Jake Lehman, Jacob Evans, Keelan Martin, Jordan McLaughlin, Jalen Noel, Amari Spellman, and Jared Vanderbilt. Currently, that equals $132 million in cap. We are cap-strapped the way it is right now. But moving forward, going into next year, we only have $96 million of cap. And that is with James Johnson's $16 million player option. I am going to assume he accepts that. I don't think he's going to get anything better than that going anywhere else on a long-term deal. I think $16 million is kind of the top of what he's going to get. What kind of free agents do you think we could bring in? I've got a couple of guys here that I want to target, like Danilo Gallinari, maybe Harry Giles, Tristan Thompson. One guy I think we should really consider, you and I have kind of talked about this, is Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. I don't think he is the greatest shooter in the world, and I think his Fangraphs show that, and his spot tracks show that. But we really don't need him to be a three-point shooter. He can come in and guard 1 through 5 the minute he gets into a Timberwolves uniform.
Okay, let's just backtrack a little bit with the basketball. So we're gonna keep it with basketball, but I want it, like, the viewers to understand the what we have for the position the T-Bulls have, because we can't just look at players without knowing the whole circumference of the situation with the Timberwolves cap situation. So currently, before this whole coronavirus thing, the cap would be 115 after the new year, after this year is done with the, you know, the championship in June. What was supposed to be, the cap would have been 115 for the 2020-2021 season. Okay, now there's projections suggesting it's going to drop because of all this and lost revenue, lost shared money. It's going to drop from 115 to about 108 million. So what that means for a lot of teams that already were cap strap is already now a really big problem for teams, because we don't get money saved under that.
Which that could be really good for us going forward with a couple of restricted free agents. So teams, there I think are 3 to 5 teams that could potentially sign Malik Beasley on a restricted deal. But now that kind of narrows it if the salary cap is going down.
Yeah, so teams that have a lot of salary cap space are the Atlanta Hawks, the New York Knicks, and the Detroit Pistons. Those three teams currently have the most salary cap space in the 2020 free agency period. And like he said, like Brent said, it's a great point, because we do have players.
But before you go forward, you've got to kind of consider they're just not going to go out and sign Malik Beasley, because teams like the Hawks already have guys at that position. So do they necessarily need Malik Beasley? No. So going forward, that could be really beneficial for us.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about restricted free agency is that there's a time. So essentially on July 1st, or the date, I think it's July 1st, so we own the rights to him. So essentially it's we can top another team's price and beat them out for the player. So if, let's say, the Detroit Pistons are like, we're moving on from Derrick Rose or something like that, and we want to try to go after Malik Beasley and offer him $18 million. Well, that has to be submitted before the time period, and then the Timberwolves have that chance to up the ante. Now, my question is, are the Timberwolves willing to make the interesting sacrifice of having more money averaged out, or sorry, more money total in the contract to Malik Beasley in different ways? So could we offer potentially, if someone's like, you know what, we want to offer him 4 years, $64 million. Well, could we do $68 million just at a different, we backload it, or we front load the contract so it fits our cap needs? There's a lot of possibilities. That's why restricted free agency, there's so much value if you have a player that you would like to retain. So that's why, like, next week, because we're not going to have a lot of time to go over the free agents, we're going to really get in to guys like Jamichael Green and Harry Giles. But you went back and talked about Hollis Jefferson. And the interesting thing that I think about Hollis Jefferson is that he has the ability to guard 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe the 5 sometimes, but he can legitimately guard multiple positions. I would find him pretty useful on the pick and roll defense.
And that's one thing we don't have right now, is somebody that can guard multiple positions besides a guy like Josh Okogie or Jarrett Culver. So I think going forward in free agency in this draft, we don't necessarily need to find a point guard, a 2 guard, a 5 man, unless you want to move Cat to the 4. I am fine moving Cat to the 4 if we can get a defensive big man in here that only wants to play defense and rebound.
Yeah, and there's we're going to go over some guys next week. You know, guys that don't have a big role on their team. So what I mean by that is guys that play less than, let's say, 28 minutes a night. Guys that play 18 to 22 minutes a night that are actually efficient, but you wouldn't know it unless you looked at their underlying stats. And we're going to talk about some 36 minutes numbers underneath guys like Larry Nance Jr. is a guy that I actually played alongside Tristan Thompson in Cleveland. He's only 27 years old. His underlying stats are very impressive. Harry Giles, I know Brent likes to talk about him. He's a good person to talk about who he is as a player, how he helps Towns. And maybe Danilo Gallinari, Hollis Jefferson, Joe Harris, and Greg Monroe, I believe, plays. Where is he playing?
Greg Monroe is currently playing overseas for Bayern Munich in the German league. I don't know what it would take to get him off of that contract, or if that's even a, if it's a 1 year contract and it's done. But I think he's one of the best rebounders in the NBA, or in the past years in the NBA, not necessarily now, because obviously he's not playing in the NBA right now. But if we can get him to come over from Bayern Munich to play the five and move Cat to the four, I think that'd be really beneficial for us.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder how much money it would take. And I don't know how their contracts work out.
I don't know if he needs a buyout or if it's a 1 year deal and it's done. I'm really not sure. I'll look into that for next week.
Yeah, I don't know how that works over. That's a good question. But we're going to go over a good 10 or 12 guys, break them down, tell you what it looks like, how that fits with our team, because we're missing a couple things in the pick and roll defense and we need help for Karl-Anthony Towns.
Going over next week's schedule, yeah, it's going to be a lot of free agents, maybe some trade candidates. Like, we had links to Aaron Gordon earlier in the year. Maybe we can go get him, a guy like Miles Turner. What would he cost to bring over? Devin Booker, question mark. Yeah. We know he wants to play alongside Cat and D'Angelo Russell, but that would be three max contracts, like kind of the Warriors did 2 years ago, where it's going to be a lot of low-end guys after that, which with those three scorers, if we can get low-end guys that want to play defensive rebound, let's just roll it out there and see what we got. And then going off of that, I've got 10 guys I think we can target in the draft. Three that we can target with our first pick, whether it's pick number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever we get slotted at. I've got four guys we could target at pick 16, because I think that's where that second pick will be, right around the 16-17 area. And then a couple guys to target in the second round. But with that being said, we've got about a minute left. Again, we want to say thank you for listening. If you've got any questions, feel free to email us or send us a message on Twitter. We're happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you for listening to the Minnesota Sports Insider Podcast. We'll be back next week.